Hello, and welcome to episode 24 of the My Movie DNA podcast. My name is Johnny Andrews, I'm a movie-loving Englishman, and I'm coming to you from Auckland, New Zealand. Thank you for tuning in. My guest for this episode is music supervisor Ron Payne. Ron started his Hollywood career as a production assistant for John Hughes in 1984. He went on to become a set PA on Weird Science, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Pretty in Pink, and then a music supervisor and music coordinator on Some Kind of Wonderful, Planes, Trains and Automobiles, She's Having a Baby, The Great Outdoors, Uncle Buck, and National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and then a post-production supervisor on Home Alone. This conversation was recorded online in early March of 2024. Our talk covers the Marx Brothers, the Beatles and John Ford, accidentally slipping a Monty Python quote into a John Hughes film, and we discuss whether you should say yes when Molly Ringwald wants to swap sunglasses with you seconds before she's due to do a take on Pretty in Pink. Okay, here we go. Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Yeah, good. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks. Is it afternoon or morning for you?
It's morning. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. I've got the day off today to watch the Oscars.
Oh, that's right. It's awesome. Yeah, busy day today.
It is a
clock's
busy day.
Clock's changing, the Oscars.
Yeah, yeah. Clock's changing as well. I was so paranoid that I was giving you the wrong time and you'd be, I don't know, dialing on it like 3 hours ago or something like that. But hopefully it's worked out okay. Hey, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
You're my first American guest.
Wow. So quite a responsibility representing all of America.
It is a little bit, yeah. Now, you're in Indiana?
I am.
Whereabouts in Indiana?
I'm in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Ah, I've heard of that name. Is that famous for something?
Ooh, famous?
Why would I have heard it?
Well, it gets name dropped in a few movies here and there.
Right.
Indiana seems to be a nice place for Hollywood to say, oh, middle America.
Gotcha.
So there was a movie that was mentions Terre Haute. Ever see the movie Breaking Away?
No, I don't think so.
About the bicycle race? Okay.
Oh, hold on. The Kevin Costner one?
No, this would have been Dennis Quaid and Daniel Stern back in the late 70s.
Right, okay, no.
But no, it's about 2.5 hours from my hometown of Fairmont, Indiana, which is also famous. I don't know. James Dean?
Ah, of course. That's where he's from?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, okay. So, as I just mentioned, you're my first American guest, so so you are representing all of America today, which is good.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And it's Oscars Day. Will you be watching the Oscars later?
I will. It's so disappointing sometimes.
Just
the show itself.
The show itself, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
They can't really get it right, can they? It's sort of too long, not funny enough.
No, it's... The broadcast is always a little disappointing. I think they're trying to start an hour earlier. I've given up. I mean, I try to record it because I go to sleep long before they end.
Yeah,
which is usually past midnight here. So,
yeah, I'm from the UK originally, as you can probably tell. And when I lived in the UK, you would have to stay up all night to watch the Oscars and go to bed at like 5 a.m. In New Zealand, it's timed brilliantly, so I take the day off work and it's in the afternoon. It's like it's tailor made for me.
Yeah, when I lived in Los Angeles, it was great because it would start,
of course,
you know, 5:36,
yeah.
And it'd be done by 9 or 9:30, and it's great.
So, Ron, I was introduced to you via Tarquin Gotch, who you know pretty well.
I spent
many years working with.
I did, yeah. My colleague, I call him Shark. I think his name evolved from Tarquin to Tark to Tark the Shark to eventually I've been calling him Shark for years.
Nice. And are you still in touch?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. We worked on this, the box set project for the last probably three. Oh, there you go. Yeah.
I love it.
About the last 3 years. So yeah, we stayed in touch here and there, but, we're in touch a lot more regularly working on the box set.
So let's go back to the beginning. So you started as a PA for John Hughes. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep. He was at Universal. He had his staff at that time included his personal assistant Jane, and there was a receptionist Kathleen, and they'd gotten to the point where they needed to hire a production assistant. You know, someone to run errands and do the dirty work. So that was me. So yeah, took my paltry resume in. I'd been in town for 9 months, maybe.
And you'd moved there from Indiana? Were you from Indiana originally?
Yeah. After college, I moved to Los Angeles, packed up my car and my albums, and I probably had more albums than clothes, and moved to Los Angeles. And then I worked for this interior decorator. My first job there in town was running errands for this interior decorator, and she had a bunch of celebrity clients, and she also had other folks that worked in her office, and they came out of Francis Coppola's Zoetrope projects. And they, Nancy and Terry worked in the office there, and they were friends with Jane, and Jane had just gotten this job with this brand new director named John Hughes. And so they said they were looking for PA. And so, you know, word of mouth, and Nancy and Terry said, oh, we know a guy, just moved to town looking for a job.
And had you gone to LA to get into movies? Was that any part of the plan?
That was kind of the plan, yeah.
Right, nice. And it worked out.
It did, yeah.
At what point did you figure out that you'd landed on your feet and you'd got a job for this amazing director?
Oh, right away. Yeah, I'd been in town for almost a year, and it was a strange coincidence. Through my current boss's other clients, I ended up meeting somebody who worked for Harold Ramis. Ah. And just as luck would have it, I had like an interview with John Hughes on, I don't know, Wednesday, and a meeting with Harold Ramis interview for a job on Thursday.
Yeah.
And I told myself, I've been here almost a year. The first offer I get, I'm taking it. Because I was familiar with both of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Harold Ramis through SCTV, which I absolutely loved. And of course, John, by that, you know, I had seen 16 Candles just before I left Indiana to move to Hollywood. So, yeah. And then went to Universal and met John and Jane. And John sat there on the couch, and I sat in the chair nervously answering his questions. And kind of looked at me and it's like, well, you want the job? I'm like, yeah. So went home and celebrated and called Harold Ramis's office and said, I'll have to cancel tomorrow. Thanks, but, you know.
Do you ever wonder what might have happened if those 2 days had been switched around? Yeah.
I have thought about that. Yeah. And again, huge Harold Ramis fan, huge SCTV fan. Of course, Harold Ramis directed Vacation that John wrote.
Yeah.
Coincidence there. But yeah, I think working for John, I don't know, at one point I counted, you know, I worked on maybe 11 movies for John in the same time frame. I think Harold Ramis made 2 or 3.
Right.
So, yeah.
So we're going to talk to you all about your favorite films today. Are you much of a movie person? Obviously, you've worked in the movie industry, but that not necessarily means you're a movie guy.
I do. I probably like movies more than the average person. Yeah, I love movies. I love music as much, and that's where I think I was really fortunate with John. You know, he loved music more than movies, and Harold Ramis didn't quite have that. I'm sure he had great music taste, but he didn't quite have that use of and love of music in his movies that John did. So
yeah, sure.
Yeah.
The one question I didn't send you to try and slightly catch you off guard is, what was the last film you watched?
Oh, golly. We just watched Napoleon.
Ah, yes.
A couple of days ago.
With Joaquin?
With Joaquin, yeah.
What did you think?
I really wanted to love it because I love history and I love big historical epics. And yeah, it's fine. Have you seen it?
I have. I thought it was an interesting choice to play Napoleon as a petulant Californian. I mean, there's that one bit where I think he's talking to one of the British admirals and he's like, you think you're so great because you've got boats.
You think you're so great because you have boats.
And then he just storms off. What?
Yeah. Well, obviously when I saw the movie was coming out, I thought, you know, I'm going to want to see this movie. So I went to try to find a book on Napoleon to kind of bone up. Cause I saw some initial criticism of it wasn't historically accurate. And these movies never are fully historically accurate, but I prefer them to be closer than not. And the only book that it was in our university library, I work at a university right now. And was a book, and I started it, and it was just so dry and awful. It just read like, today we marched to wherever, and then there was no, so I didn't really know that much about him going in when I watched the movie, so I don't know how accurate it really was. I will try to catch up more than just a Wikipedia page at some point with Napoleon. But yeah, felt like we got to know Napoleon, his motivation, none of that. It was just him. I don't know. Yeah. I think Joaquin Phoenix is a great actor, but it just,
Something didn't hit right.
Yeah.
I just watched on the big screen. I saw the Bill and Ted trilogy last weekend. And obviously Napoleon turns up in the first one of that. They take him to a water park. So I think it was a bit more historically accurate than that one, but I'm still not convinced. You mentioned you worked at university. What do you do there? You're a teacher?
No, I work in the Office of Admission at Indiana State University.
Indiana State.
Yep.
Nice. So you started as a PA for John, and you were hired on the Breakfast Club in early 1984?
Yeah, it would have been. I started August or September of 84.
Okay.
And Breakfast Club had wrapped production, and they were in post-production.
Yep.
And then production started on Weird Science, I think, in October.
Yep.
So I came in at the, Breakfast Club was in post and prep for Weird Science. And then I'd only been on for, a month or so, and then became a set PA. The Weird Science began shooting on location in Chicago first in October. In fact, one of my first jobs was John and his wife, Nancy, wanted to switch their cars. Of course, they still maintained a residence in Chicago, even though they were now living in Los Angeles as he was pursuing his film career. So I drove their LA car to Chicago, and then we shot on location in Chicago for Weird Science. And then when the shoot moved back to LA to the stage, I drove their other car back.
Brilliant.
That was fun. I love driving across country. That was a good trip.
And that's Route 66, isn't it, from LA to... Chicago to West.
You can't. That's the southern way to get there. I took the northern route.
Gotcha.
And I went because I love the Rocky Mountains, and I went through kind of the Rocky Mountains and the plains.
Fantastic.
But when I drove to California from Indiana for the first time, I took the old Route 66. Yeah. Although not much of Route 66, the original still exists. It's been replaced mostly by interstate. But there you go.
Yeah.
The spirit of it's still there.
Can you remember your earliest movie memory?
Well, do you mean going to a theater or just seeing a movie?
Anything,
on TV?
Anything you can remember movie related.
Yeah. The first theater experience I remember is my dad took my sister and I to see a Disney movie called Blackbeard's Ghost.
Oh, yeah.
One of those kind of would have been late 1960s, I don't know, 67, 68 probably, with Dean Jones, one of those Disney movies. So my mom must have been busy doing something, so Dad took my sister and I to see that. And that's my first theater experience, I remember.
How old would you have been then?
I think I was about 8. And then, but the first movie that I remember watching was The Wizard of Oz, was on American television. Golly, I was born in 1960, so it was probably on TV at that point. It probably started in the late 50s, I would guess.
Yeah.
And it was on TV every year, and I never missed it ever.
Yeah.
And so that was, just spellbound.
It is incredible. And it's still incredible. You know, like the power of it just hasn't gone, has it?
No, it's still probably my favorite movie. Yeah.
So you started as a PA for John. Were you doing anything music related at that point before you became a music supervisor, music coordinator?
Yeah, in my production assistant way. Of course, John had a true love of music, as I did, and I think that's where we kind of connected initially. One of the first things I remember doing for him when I started working for him was he had this handwritten list on a yellow legal pad of, I don't know, maybe 40 or 50 singles that he remembered probably from his teen years, I assume, because they were all, 58 to 62 or 3. Kind of that pre-Beatle rock period.
Sure.
But he had a list, and these were, and you got to remember in 1984, no internet.
Yeah.
So you can't just digitally call up a song. You had to find the, if you wanted a song, you had to find the physical product. So he gave me this list and was like, you know, I want these records. And I'm like, well, so I, of course, Los Angeles is, you know, a huge city with at that time, a ton of record stores. And I scoured the city. It took me a few days because some of them were like collectors. Mm-hmm. I mean, really obscure stuff, but it, it helped inform me some great stuff. So I found the large majority, if not all of those, and within a few days and turned them in. I think he was like, oh, all right. Well, here's somebody who kind of knows what's going on.
Super. So, so you said you, you connected with John about music. What sort of music were you into at that point? Were you an Anglophile like he was?
I was.
Yep. I can see Elvis up on the wall over there, Elvis Costello.
Yeah. Elvis Costello. Yeah. So, yeah, my music, well, my music journey, I guess, kind of started with, you know, because of my age, you know, Elton John was dominating radio in the mid-70s when I was a young lad. But yeah, the Beatles were my first love. And John was a massive Beatles fan. And we, when those Beatle bootlegs, this would have been, we were doing Uncle Buck, so that would have been 88, 89. Those that first run of Beatle bootlegs started coming out. I remember like the, I don't know, are you a Beatles fan?
Big Beatles fan.
Because
yeah.
this podcast will now be 3 hours long, just talking about the Beatles.
Hey, let's do it.
Those bootlegs first started coming out on the Yellow Dog label,
yep,
and the Backtracks label in about 89. So I found a record store. And in those days, you know, the bootlegs were sold under the counter. You kind of didn't know what to ask for, what to look for. But yeah, I started, and he, John, of course, fell in love with those Beatle bootlegs, as did me and everybody else. So, yeah.
I have a lot of record collecting friends who, so all these official outtakes that are coming out now on the, you know, that Apple are putting out for each of the studio albums, a lot of my friends have heard them before because of those bootleg albums, which I never had. So it's like a revelation for me. But yeah, I can understand how important those things were when they came out.
Oh yeah. John loved them. So he had me like go back and like buy a copy for his agent and other friends, and he would hand them out. They were revelatory.
Brilliant.
I mean, at that time. Yeah.
What do you think about the latest new song that they brought out at the end of last year?
I know it's true. It's all because of you. And if I make it through, it's all because of you.
Well, I love it. Yeah. I thought when I first heard it, I was amazed at the quality of John's voice because, you know, we'd all, of course, seen some of that AI technology working on the Get Back documentary, the Peter Jackson thing,
yep,
improving audio quality. But I thought John's voice, I was just, wow. And it immediately made me think, okay, now I want to hear Live at the Star Club in Hamburg.
Yes.
Now I want to hear. So, yeah, waiting for all that to get cleaned up. But I love it. You know, there's very few. Are there any Beatles stuff? I really just think, ugh, forget it. No, I don't think there are.
Maxwell Silverhammer? Mr. Moonlight?
They don't. Well, Mr. Moonlight, maybe not a great song, but John's voice, gosh, how can you not just enthralled to his voice on even on Mr. Moonlight? He's just belting it.
Mr. Moonlight, you came to me one summer night.
So if you came in on the Breakfast Club, so you hadn't shot Ferris Bueller at that point?
No. Yeah, so... yeah, came in at the end of Breakfast Club, went to Chicago and to start Weird Science, came back to L.A., and then John put the finishing touches on Breakfast Club, and that was released in February of 85. And then Weird Science came out, like, was it July, June, July, August?
Because I spoke to Tarquin briefly on this, but, I mean, it was so big to hear a Beatles song in Ferris Bueller. I mean, it just never happens.
going to be a fry cook on Venus.
I think we were, my recollection is we were very lucky, because there was a period of time, and it must have been, because Ferris started in...
It's 86, so, isn't it? So it would have started Weird in 85?
Weird Science came out in August of 85. We'd started shooting Ferris around that time.
Yeah.
Because Ferris came out in June of 86. So, yeah, John wanted Twist and Shout. And, of course, he had to nail that. He had to shoot to it, had the whole parade sequence. Matthew does the choreography and does the whole thing to Twist and Shout.
Yeah.
Or sorry, no, Donkey Jane and Twist and Shout. Yep. But anyway, there was, my recollection is at that time, whatever Beatle lawsuits had settled and before others began, there was this thing, I think Capitol Records had what they called the Beatle Committee. I don't think the Beatles themselves through Apple had control of things yet.
Right.
And there was like this Beatles Committee that would approve or not approve sync requests for films and commercials and whatnot. And I'll bet, I've never taken the time to look, but there was another movie around the same time called Can't Buy Me Love with Patrick Dempsey.
Yep, yep, I know it well.
Yeah, and I think they had a Beatles track.
Yep, it's over the opening credits. Yep.
Yeah.
It's Can't Buy Me Love.
So so I think the Beatles committee at Capitol approved that use.
Yep.
And our use of Twist and Shout and Ferris.
Would Twist and Shout have been easier to get because it's a cover song and not a Lennon and McCartney original?
I don't think so. I don't think publishing was ever usually a problem. Okay. It was always the master sync rights.
Right.
Publishers, that you know, they're typically willing to go along.
They want the exposure and the money.
Well, their publishers aren't worried about the original recording. They're worried about the song and exploiting it in a good way, exploiting it as often as they can with as many people as they can.
Yep. And were you at all involved with the furore with Paul McCartney not appreciating the use of additional brass in?
I remember being bummed at the time when that little quote came out, wherever it was.
Yeah.
And I thought Ira Newborn adding horns to it was perfectly appropriate. It would have been odd to have the marching band and not hear horns.
Yeah.
And I didn't think it detracted from the song at all.
Nope. I mean, it's perfect.
Yeah. I it didn't improve it, because you can't improve perfection.
Yep.
But I thought it put it in a perfectly fine context and helped everybody appreciate the song, the beauty that it is. Yeah.
Ron Payne, what kind of films were you into when you were growing up?
Oh, comedies. Comedies are my favorite. So I was a strange teenager in that I was always on the lookout for Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Marx Brothers, W.C. Fields. I mean, that was where, I remember there was a pizza chain here in the U.S. called, at that time in the 70s, called Shakey's Pizza. And their gimmick was to have TVs around in the restaurant up on the wall, and they would play old silent movies.
Mm.
And I remember we were in Nebraska visiting my aunt and uncle and cousins, and we went to a Shakey's, and I remember I couldn't focus on eating my pizza at all because I was just watching those screens. I had never really seen... And there was probably, you know, Keystone Cops and that kind of stuff, but I just loved it. I was enthralled by that. So, yeah, when I, you know, eventually started to get to see Chaplin and Buster Keaton and Laurel and Hardy, oh, man. So, yeah, that was my first love.
And did that love of comedies from the silent era and beyond, were you a fan of, like, obviously you were growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, were you a fan of comedies, like contemporary comedies at the time? Like, can you remember any big ones you were into?
Yeah, I remember seeing, another near-perfect movie, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Fantastic.
I have a memory of it, for some reason, PBS showing it on American television in the late 70s. Like, it came out, 75, I think? So within a few years, it was, because it would never come to a theater in Indiana. Life of Brian eventually did for a brief time in, 79. But yeah, Monty Python. Oh my gosh, I was buying all of those Monty Python albums, and then when I finally got to see Holy Grail, oh my gosh!
Old woman,
ma'am,
sorry. What knight lives in that castle over there?
I'm 37.
What?
I'm 37. I'm not old.
Well, I can't just call you ma'am.
You could say Dennis.
I didn't know you were called Dennis.
Well, you didn't bother to find out, did you?
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you looked...
What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior.
Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice. And how'd you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society. If there's ever going to be any progress...
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here. Oh, how'd you do?
How do you do, good lady? I'm Arthur, King of the Britons. Whose castle is that?
King of the who?
The Britons.
Who are the Britons?
Well, we all are. We are all Britons. And I am your king.
Oh, didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship. A self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working classes...
Oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
That's what it's all about. If only people would...
Please, please, good people. I am in haste. Who lives in that castle?
No one lives there.
Then who is your lord?
We don't have a lord.
What?
I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings.
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake. Her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony.
Be quiet!
Oh, but you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Shut up!
Oh, but if I went round saying I was an emperor, just because some moistened bint had lobbed a scimitar at me, they put me away.
Shut up! Will you shut up?
Ah, now we see the violence inherent in the system.
Shut up!
Oh, come and see the violence inherent in the system! Help! Help! I'm being repressed!
Bloody peasant!
Oh, what a giveaway. Did you hear that? Did you hear that, eh? That's what I'm on about. Did you see him repressing me? You saw it, didn't you?
I remember writing down, watching it on PBS and then getting a notepad and like writing down as many jokes and bits as I could remember because, I mean, it was like one and done.
Brilliant.
There were no VCRs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So.
And that sort of humor, that very British humor, were you into that because you were into British music and sorry, my friend the Dove has just turned up. Let me show you that.
Oh, wow.
So this is
that's a real dove.
It is a real dove. So this is Lizzie. My wife and my daughters rescued her from she was about to drown at the beach. And she just comes and says hello every day and has some food. It's the second time she's been on the podcast.
Nice.
Where were we? I was asking about whether you were into Monty Python as part of, you know, being into British music. And were you into British comedy as well? Or was it separate to that?
Yeah. I mean, not British comedy because it was British, just, I guess, British comedy because it was funny.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like for me, whether it's music or movies or whatever, I don't so much worry about the time or the era. If it's funny or good, I like it. So, yeah, music, I love stuff from the 20s and 30s as much as anything. Black and white movies don't bother me.
And you...
So, yeah, it wasn't British music specifically, but...
Yeah.
I mean, British comedy specifically.
And you're still a fan of comedy, like recent comedies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, still watch... Of course, Saturday Night Live's been on for...
Forever.
50 years here, so still watching that.
Do you have a favorite movie genre? Comedy, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I'd say comedy, probably. But it's not like as long as it's a good movie. So, yeah, action, thrillers, westerns. Oh my gosh, I love a good western.
Really?
Gangster movies. But the only genre that I'm less interested in, horror movies don't do much for me. But other than that, love documentaries. My gosh, I love a good documentary.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm just watching... So every year for the Oscars, I try and watch as many nominated films as I can. And I'm really cutting it down to the wire, and I'm in the middle of To Kill a Tiger, which is one of the Oscar-nominated documentary features this year. I really do like documentaries.
Yeah, I used to play that game of trying to see all the Oscar movies, and I gave up on that long ago.
It's hard work. It really is hard work.
Yeah, I just don't have the time.
Yeah.
I don't have the time anymore.
Yeah. And I don't know about, I'm guessing in America it might be different, but here, I mean, one of the foreign language nominees this year doesn't come out in New Zealand until like next month, like until after the Oscars. Like, you know, what's the point? I don't know if you saw The Holdovers recently, the Paul Giamatti film that's nominated.
Not yet. No.
Well, that's a Christmas movie. And we got it in New Zealand in January, which, no.
Yeah, a few years ago, I kind of gave up going to the theater the day of or the weekend of.
And yeah.
I usually wait till it's
streaming,
comes on TV or streaming or something.
Yeah.
You used to be able to rent stuff. Can't rent stuff anymore. Well, yeah, I mean, you can rent it streaming, but
It's weird, isn't it? I really
stores,
miss.
Can't even go to a store.
Video stores, yeah. I mean, we lost our last Blockbuster maybe 10 years ago here. And there's nothing now. When you see those like nostalgia clips on YouTube or whatever, and it's people going to Blockbuster in 1986, it's like fantastic. That's what I used to love.
Well, what I loved about video stores, Blockbusters went away here a long time ago, but we had some more local or regional video stores, but they've gone out now. But when streaming came along, I thought, okay, good. Finally, yes. So there'll be tens of thousands of movies available, and I can watch some D.W. Griffith silent movies at my, at my beck and call.
Yeah.
No, it's like, what do you mean coming and going this month? What are you talking about? It should just all be there all the time.
Yeah, my wife's been burnt by that, and she's been in the middle of a TV show, and it's just finished, and it's just gone, just disappeared. What? So you're working as a PA for John, and then you became a music supervisor or a music coordinator on Some Kind of Wonderful, Planes, Trains and Automobiles, She's Having a Baby, Great Outdoors, Uncle Buck, and National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Yes.
Is that all of them?
No. Let's see. I was a set PA, Weird Science, Ferris, Pretty in Pink. It was during Weird Science that I kind of started doing music stuff. John's original idea for the music in Weird Science was 1950s doo-wop.
Yeah.
And so when it came time to do the first test screening, he had it all 1950s doo-wop music.
And they didn't like it?
No, the preview audience didn't like it. And so he was kind of frustrated. And within a day or two, he's like, put some music in, replace the doo-wop stuff. So, Jane gave me the office credit card, and away I went to the record store and grabbed a bunch of stuff, went home and
brilliant,
and took a VHS of the movie and made some spotting notes and put it all on a cassette and gave the cassette to Jane. And then that night, about 9 o'clock or so, John calls me at home, and he was just, oh my gosh, this is so great, and that, and blah, 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 blah. And we talked for a long time. And so from that point forward, when I found the records, the obscure records he remembered as a preteen, and then this little exercise of giving him some ideas, and three of those actually stuck around to the final cut, but in Weird Science. But yeah, so I think from that point forward, I was in,
And would you have spent time on set a lot, or would you have been just office based in those days?
No, I was on set at most of the movies. Yeah, I was set PA on Weird Science, Pretty in Pink, Ferris, and then I was in the office, in between shoots. Probably by the end of Ferris, that's when I made my move, and I think I was kind of music coordinator at that point because they hired someone to replace me as the PA.
Gotcha.
So that was about the time Tarquin came in and kind of Hughes Music
started
in its infancy, kind of started. So it would have been Some Kind of Wonderful-ish.
Yeah. Do you remember meeting Tarquin for the first time?
I do. Yeah, we were shooting Weird Science, and he came to the set to visit. He was friends with Kelly LeBrock, who was a star of Weird Science, and he came to visit her, and we were shooting, and on a movie set there's a lot of downtime, right? So as you're waiting for the DP and the crew to set up the next shot, there's quite a bit of time. So Tarquin comes to visit Kelly, and of course Kelly introduces him to John, and of course Tarquin's in the British music industry, and John's all ears. I think it really helped Tarquin. You know, Tarquin managed the general public, and they had their big hit Tenderness had come out that summer of 84. Yeah. So we're shooting Weird Science in the fall of 84. It's just now breaking in America. John and his wife, Nancy, both love that song. So all of a sudden there's the manager of your favorite hit at the moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, they got on and, took a few months because, you know, around the exact same time, of course, with Pretty in Pink, the Psychedelic Furs, Les Mills was the manager of the Psychedelic Furs, and Les was a good guy. And so John had both Les Mills and Tarquin, both his British music connection. And they both were feeding John some songs. And I think when John in his mind began to formulate, you know, this concept of Hughes music, I think he I'm assuming, I don't know this for sure, but I think he was kind of debating, well, should it be Les or Tarquin? And then Les also managed the Flower Pot Men, and we were going to use Beat City for Ferris. And love so it. They were going to record
I
it.
I love it.
And then John.
Such a fantastic song. And this is what I said to Tarquin. I'm so happy that box set came out because I only buy vinyl, and I've never been able to have Beat City by the Flower Pot Men on anything. I think it only came out as like a fan club 7-inch, 45 back in the day. And now I've got it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, no, that's a great song. Yeah, so there was no Ferris soundtrack. So to remedy that, John pressed up a promo 7-inch 45 single with Flower Pot Men on one side and Blue Room on the other. And we stuffed those. I mean, of course, every kid that wrote John a fan letter, he kind of kept this list. And then he wrote these newsletters and did a newsletter. In fact, they're reproduced in the box set.
Yeah.
So, So then on the Ferris one, he sent out, or maybe it was the Some Kind of, no, it would have been the Some Kind of Wonderful one, because the newsletters went out to promote the movies. So after Ferris had come out, and then for the next one was Some Kind of Wonderful, he included the Flower Pot Men Blue Room 45 in that package. But yeah, so I got to go to England for the recording of that. I was out there with Ben and Adam at the Manor, the studio in Oxford, and brought the master tapes back. And I think at the same time, John had kind of sent me as a bit of a spy. Check out Tarquin's office. Check out Les's office. Kind of what's going on there. And so I don't think my opinion had swayed it one way or the other. But so Tarquin eventually was then kind of asked to kind of come and work for John as his music supervisor, which he jumped on.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier around test screenings, and that comes up in the liner notes in the box set quite often, that, you know, constantly, you know, testing films with audiences, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, particularly Planes, Trains and Automobiles, which seem to have like quite a long gestational period where John Hughes was testing different things. Is that still like a big thing in the movie industry, that they test things like this? Or
I really don't know. I've been away for like 25 years, 30 years. Yeah, so I assume so. I mean, test screenings were there at the inception, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're making a movie for an audience, why wouldn't you, if you have the opportunity to test it and get some opinions?
Yeah. I just don't hear about it these days. I mean, I'm guessing, obviously, you're not allowed to talk about it maybe if you go to a test screening, but it just seems something that happened a lot in like the 80s and then...
I don't know. Yeah. Well, Planes, Trains, we didn't have near the time on that. So when you said it was like a long period, it wasn't really a long period of time. Ferris had a really long, maybe a year to work on post-production on that and kind of fine tune and get it right. Planes and Trains was a rush because he had shot She's Having a Baby first. And then the studio wanted planes and trains for, you know, for that holiday. And so it was a time crunch. And when that original ending didn't work, John and Paul Hirsch, the editor, and others kind of struggled to find the way, and, you know, figured it out at the end. In fact, in the movie, you can still see, you know, where when Steve Martin gets back, goes back to see John Candy at the train station. If you notice, the shot is reversed. Instead of him walking,
guy walking,
he's walking
back.
The part on Steve Martin's hair, you can see is different because they reversed the film.
I didn't notice that. I did notice it. Yeah. The shot of the train coming back into the station, there's a guy walking backwards up the sidewalk. You can just see. I'll have a look for Steve's hair. Do you have a favorite of all the films that you worked on for John?
Oh, golly.
Or is it too hard a question?
What context? Yeah. I mean, Planes and Trains is probably the funniest one.
Yeah.
I mean, there was so much funny stuff that got cut out along the way. But I remember those test screenings. I remember a guy sitting in the aisle laughing so hard, he leaned over and put his hand on the floor, gasping for breath. I was like, laughing so hard. So I would say PTA was probably the funniest. I thought She's Having a Baby had the best soundtrack album. I think that could stand alone as just an album. Yeah, that's just an album. You could release it.
Yeah.
Doesn't need a movie.
Yeah, the Kate Bush song is something else, right?
Really came through with that. That was a minor miracle. We had struggled. There was a song. The end. That scene was This Mortal Coil, Song to the Siren, a Tim Buckley cover. They were on the 4AD label in the late 80s. 4AD was it's a very artsy label, and they were kind of anti-commercial in a sense, and they didn't want to license it. And you know, the movie had been shot to it, edited to it, and everybody's loved it for a year. And we're all, you know, and then and Tarquin really bailed us out with the Kate Bush idea, and he goes to Kate Bush and we gave her the tape, and she came back with just this perfect, I mean, better than This Mortal Coil. I mean, it fit, and it was a woman's voice, you know, just perfect.
Yeah. I even like just the musical sequence with all the lawnmowers. It's fantastic. What's that?
Yeah, we called it the Lawnmower Ballet, Topperhead.
Oh, that's right.
It's not on the album.
Yeah.
It was that was an existing 45. Of course, John. Well, we were all Clash fans, obviously, and how could you not be a Clash fan in the 80s? And but Topper, after he left, had put this single out of a cover of Drummond Man, an old Gene Krupa 1940s jazz thing. And John loved that record, so he devised this whole, what we call the Lawnmower Ballet sequence, had it choreographed with a really wry comment on life in the suburbs. And that was a great, I loved that sequence. But it wasn't actually on the album, but it was released, the She's Having a Baby single. It was the B-side of the single.
Ah, gotcha. Ron Payne, do you have a favorite actor?
Oh, golly. Groucho Marx. And, obviously, you know, love all the classic Hollywood, John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, Meryl Streep, and Tom Hanks, obviously, in today's world. Of course, they're getting on more towards the end of their career than the beginning.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, I mean, Burt Lancaster, there's a lot of really good actors. It's just when you can find that, because not every actor, you know, there's plenty of people we all like actors and go to their movies and it's like, meh, no one bats a thousand.
I shamefully hadn't seen a Marx Brothers film until last year.
Wow.
They'd never come into my orbit. But last year I watched The Day at the Races and Night of the Opera, I think. Oh, no, Duck Soup. And I was blown away by Harpo. Really made me laugh. Yeah. I'd obviously seen Groucho talk before in clips, but I'd never seen Harpo before. And it really made me want to watch more of them.
They were all three great.
Do you have a favorite Marx Brothers film?
Oh, I think Duck Soup is probably the strongest. They all have memorable bits and scenes, but that's probably the best one beginning to end.
Yeah. So around about Uncle Buck time, you turned from a music supervisor, music coordinator into an actor?
Well, the great thing about working for John is, you know, he'd squeeze you in here and there. I think my first, Pretty in Pink would have been my first one.
Right.
Howie put me in. I was the set PA, and he let me do a little sequence when Molly goes out into the courtyard where she's going to see Andrew McCarthy. That's me leaning against the door when Andrew McCarthy goes out into the courtyard to kind of ask Molly out on the date. And he goes into the weird teenager part of the thing, and we're all giving. So me, I'm representing, you know, weird teenagers, although I'm 25 at the time. But so that was my first appearance doing that. In fact, what I remember about that sequence is, of course, as a set PA, my job is to go get the actor and bring him to the set when the setup's done and time's ready. And so costumer had given Molly these small little sunglasses to wear in that scene. And just me, you know, I just had a pair of fake Ray-Bans on just at work in the sun, you know, the bright sun. So we're walking to the stage and Molly's like, trade me sunglasses. I don't like these. And I'm like, yeah, sure. So then I wore the sunglasses she was supposed to be wearing in that sequence. And she's wearing my Ray-Ban knockoffs. Yeah.
Fantastic. I'm going to go and watch that after this and have a look.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think then, I made a little cameo appearance in Pretty in Pink. I'm a little bit in Ferris. Where am I in Ferris? Oh, in Pretty in Pink, I'm also in the beginning where the lawn sweeper is going through the street. Yeah. And my car, that's me driving my car, passing it.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. But then in Ferris, I'm in when the Charlie Sheen sequence, when they're at the police station with Jennifer Grey, he was coming from Malibu and we were shooting downtown. He was, you know, traffic. He was hours late. So they shot me. So they didn't have time to get all the coverage for him that day because, you know, he was kind of late getting there and had to go. So months later, when the cracking the knuckles, that's me. Because we're doing that on the stage weeks later because they didn't have time to get to it while he was there. And then, Uncle Buck. Yeah, then I got an actual speaking role in Uncle Buck.
Does anyone have a special story to tell a class about something that happened this week? Maisie.
My uncle was microwaving my socks and the dog threw up on the couch for about an hour.
Honest?
Yes.
Why was your uncle microwaving your socks?
He can't get the goddamn washing machine to work.
Blasphemer!
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Did you want to be an actor or were you like, it sounds like you were coerced into a...
No, not coerced. Loving the opportunity and grateful for the opportunity. That was just John being, you know, he was such an improviser and he would improvise things with, in that sequence, he improvised a bunch of stuff with Maisie, you know. And then weeks later, you got to shoot the other side of it. And it's like, well, who do I get to do that? You know, and I got to find an actor and we got to hire somebody. And like, well, Ron, you just do it. So I was the teacher and Bill Brown, my colleague, was starting to do second unit directing. And Bill was our post-production supervisor and also was starting at that time was doing some second unit directing. So Bill and I did that. We would just have to, you know, of course, we had all of the things that we had to shoot for an opposite reaction to everything Maisie did, all the stuff John had improvised with her. So we did quite a few different bits. The blasphemer thing was just me we've done three or four of them, and I just kind of did that one as a joke. It's from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. When they're getting ready to stone the guy, yep. And John Cleese is the Roman soldier. Yep. And
are there any women here?
So he says, "Blasphemer,
you have been found guilty by the elders of the town of uttering the name of our Lord, and so as a blasphemer, you are to be stoned to death. Look, I'd had a lovely supper, and all I said to my wife was, that piece of halibut was good enough for Jehovah.
Blasphemy!
He said it again! Did you hear him? Are there any women here today? Very well. By virtue of the authority vested in me.
Oh, lay off. We haven't started yet.
Come on. Who threw that? Who threw that stone? Come on. Sorry, I thought.
We started.
Go to the back.
Oh, dear.
Always one, isn't there?
And so I thought, well, that's obvious. They're never going to use that because, it's such a ripoff of the Monty Python bit.
Well, I didn't realize. So.
No.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So then we had it in a test screening. I thought, well, this, I'm not going to make the cut. I mean, I was in that first test screening and the blasphemer thing got a big laugh. And I thought, oh.
So it stayed in?
And then it never got a laugh in any preview after that. And I thought, well, they're going to cut it, And then it survived the cut. So very grateful.
Do you have a favorite director?
Oh, golly. Favorite director. I'm going to sound really odd because I'm not naming any contemporary. Well, the two names that came to mind were either John Ford or Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
And then in the same breath, I'd say Charlie Chaplin. My gosh, the amount of work, after a while, he kind of just began directing himself. So he was kind of a miracle, really, between writing, acting, directing, scoring. John Ford, my gosh, how can you, The Searchers and Ford Apache, Stagecoach, I mean, The Grapes of Wrath, My Darling Clementine, Three Godfathers, The Quiet Man, my gosh, John Ford, and then Spielberg, I mean, Schindler's List and Private Ryan, and those are some, he's a pretty good, that does be my two, I guess.
I just watched.
And Chaplin.
I just watched a couple of months ago How Green Was My Valley, John Ford film.
Yeah. The Welsh miners.
It's crazy. So, I mean, where I'm from in the UK is not too far from Wales. And I would have sworn when I was watching that I was watching a film shot in Wales. But they built like a replica Welsh village for Ford in like California. And it just looks like Wales. It's fantastic.
I worked with a prop man named Eddie Villa, worked for John on quite a few movies, and he told me a story. At the very beginning of his career, he worked on one of the last movies John Ford shot. I don't know, it might have been Liberty Balance or one of those. Of course, he said John Ford was just a mean old SOB, but he had this funny, I guess he worried that he maybe didn't have Final Cut or something. I don't know, but he would be sitting under camera with his hat, and while they were, shooting a sequence, if he didn't want that perspective taken, he'd take his hat off and hold it in front of the lens and block so the studio couldn't use, I don't want that angle. I want it on the other person, not this person. So he'd put his hat up. I thought that was a great story.
Fantastic. What do you think of, so I'm guessing you saw The Fablemans. You also mentioned Spielberg.
Yeah.
And obviously John Ford pops up in that at the end, played by David Lynch.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah, I forgot.
I thought it was really well done because he sort of got that grouchy, demeanor. Just right.
Yeah.
What I do like about the box set is there's a great photo of you and Tarquin here on the set of Great Outdoors.
Well, technically, that wasn't Great Outdoors.
Ah.
Well, it was, but I mean, so John Hughes bought a drum kit for John Candy. So there, John Candy, they're all up filming The Great Outdoors, which was then called Big Country, but they were up in Bass Lake, California, I think. Yeah. So John was like, oh, you know, Candy's got some downtime and he's bored, so here, take him this drum kit. So Tarquin and I drove it up to set, and on the way, we stopped at Yosemite National Park, and we did a little sightseeing. And so I got my camera out, and there was this fallen tree. So I set my camera on the tree and put the timer on and took a picture of Tarquin and I.
Nice.
But yeah, we had so it was on the way to the Great Outdoors shoot, but it technically wasn't on the set. Yep. That's in Yosemite.
And what memories do you have of working alongside John Candy?
Oh my gosh. What a beautiful and nice person he was. Just the sweetest man. And of course, I've mentioned before my love for SCTV. I was such a fan of John Candy. Such a nice man. There were times, you know, again, downtime late at night. And some of my favorite memories are just sitting in, I don't know, I mean, John Hughes and John Candy both had trailers on location when we were out. So whose ever trailer was, you know, a lot of downtime just sitting in there, just two of the funniest people the world has ever known. I'm sitting there and just watching these two guys. And one of my prouder moments was, it was Uncle Buck, because I was living in Chicago. Bill and I got apartments in this. When John moved back to Chicago, and a few of us went with him to open a Chicago office, I had somehow gone to take my trash out and to the outside of the building and got the door slept behind me. I couldn't get back in. I'm on like the second or third floor, and I had to use the fire escape ladders to get back down. Anyway, I don't remember the details of the story, but just telling that story and watching both Johns just laughing and laughing. I mean, that was some of my favorite memories, just those guys. John Candy could improvise like nobody's business, and John Hughes both. And they, I mean, there are hours and hours of outtakes from Uncle Buck. Who knows if they're still around or not, but.
You mentioned SCTV before, and I keep seeing the clip on social media, and I love it every time I see it. And it's Rick Moranis, John Candy, and Eugene Levy as like a beat group. You might know this clip, and they're just playing a song, but they're all saying this same line, and it's like, she's gone, she's gone, she's been gone so long. Does this ring a bell? And it cuts to John. It cuts to John Candy, and he stops the drum beat, and he repeats a line, but he does this really awkward like swallow like halfway through, like as I was really nervous. It's just like perfect.
So long, she's been gone, gone, gone so long.
Gone, 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 she's been gone so long. She's been gone, gone, gone so long.
Gone, 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 she's been gone so long. Gone so long.
She didn't have to leave me. She didn't have to run.
Yeah. John Candy, one of my favorite bits was when they did the Preteen World skit where they're all playing preteen kids, and John Candy's Stephen Seeley. And he does it really nervous where he tries to swallow and he can't. Yeah. That was his bit for that character. Oh,
fantastic.
My gosh, he was so fun. He was such a nice man too. Went to visit his I remember going to his offices where he did a radio show. He did a cartoon called Candyland or something. I'm foggy on all that, but sweet dear man. My gosh, he was funny. And when he and Catherine O'Hara did the bit in Home Alone.
Yeah, perfect.
No, but here in you got a little bit of a dilemma there. We got a crisis ourselves. Allow me to introduce myself. Gus Polinski.
How are you?
Polka King of the Midwest. The Kenosha Kickers.
Hi there.
Hiya.
No? That's okay. I thought you might have recognized. Anyways. I had a few hits a few years ago. That's why, just polka, polka, polka. Polka, polka, polka. No? Twin Lakes Polka. Damavuji Polka, a.k.a. Kiss Me Polka. Polka Twist.
Well, these are songs.
Yeah. Yeah, some fairly big hits for us, in the early 70s, Yeah, we sold about 623 copies of that.
In Chicago?
No, Sheboygan. Very big in Sheboygan. They loved it,
I'm sorry, did you say you could help me?
Anyway, I'm rambling here. Our flight was canceled. So we gotta drive. So, see the guy in the yellow jacket over there by the budget sign? He's gonna rent us a nice big van, and we're gonna drive to Milwaukee. Now, I heard you had some problems. You're getting to Chicago to see your kid or something?
My son, we left, and he's there.
Oh, jeez. If you have to get to Chicago, we'll gladly drive you. It's on the way to Milwaukee.
You'd give me a ride?
Sure we will. Why not? You know, you gotta get home and see your kid.
A ride to Chicago?
Sure, you know, it's Christmas time.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
You don't mind going with some polka bums?
No, I'd love to.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, I was such a fan. When Catherine Hayward coming to loop Home Alone, I had to, of course, I'm working. By that time, I'm supervising post-production.
Yeah.
I went from, like, music to, and then eventually post-production after Bill left. But, yeah, we had to, you know, I had to spend the first 10 minutes of our looping session just me worshiping Catherine O'Hara. Remember when you were the Bickersons with Dave Thomas? And then remember when you were...
Do you have any inkling why John Hughes and John Candy fell out? So Uncle Buck, obviously John Candy's the star of Uncle Buck, and then he comes back and does that segment in Home Alone. And then I don't know if he fell out of favour with him. But I mean, Tarquin said this, that Tarquin and John Candy, that they just found themselves, they were out of the picture all of a sudden.
I don't remember that. I do remember... there was a funny story where in Uncle Buck, there was a scene where John was supposed to be a little hungover. John Candy was supposed to be hungover. So perhaps being the method actor he was or wasn't, he went out drinking the night before and Tarquin was so long. And they were out all night at some blues club. And so, the next morning, John's getting ready and coming to the set, you know, early, and there's some early morning Chicago radio station, and somebody calls into the station, "Hey, you'll never believe it. I just closed a blues club with John Candy." And John Hughes was not happy. So Candy showed up a little worse for wear that day, and not a lot of shooting got done, even though he's supposed to be hungover. So, yeah, I mean, there would be little moments, but I don't remember anything ever permanent. I think John probably... No, I can't remember the year John Candy passed. 94,
yeah.
94, yeah. So I think John had kind of slowed down making movies at that point.
Yep.
Right? So I don't know that they fell out.
Okay.
I don't have a recollection of those two falling out. I think they were friends. I mean, their families would get together and the kids all knew each other. And I don't remember a falling out. I think John just kind of slowed down making movies and then John Candy passed.
Ron Payne. Do you have a favorite soundtrack or score?
Well, soundtrack, if you mean a collection of songs, then I would say The Wizard of Oz.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Score, just famous movie themes are coming to mind. So, I don't know, like obviously John Williams, Schindler's List, yeah. Something like that, but that haunting theme song. Or at the other end of the spectrum, you know, the movie The Big Country, that big Western. So, yeah, I really don't buy soundtrack albums and listen to the score.
And when you, obviously you were contributing to soundtracks for, you know, a decent portion of your life, would it be the case where you were sick of hearing these songs because it was your day job and you're listening to them over and over again? And, you know, would you ever throw on, I don't know, Planes, Trains and Automobiles and just have a listen to it? Or, you know, is it all just too familiar for you?
In the same way that I wouldn't listen to the Hughes soundtracks over and over again like I would a Beatles or a Bob Dylan record.
Yeah.
You know, and live with those. But I did revisit them a lot when we were working on the box set, and that was great to reconnect with them. But I'm never too far away from them. You know, something crops up here and there. You see something on TV or hear something on the radio, and you know, they kind of are always out there.
Just talking on the box set for a moment. Whose idea was that to was it Tarquin's idea or was it the record label's idea to actually start it? Because it's obviously a big project, right?
It was a very big project, and it took a long time. No, Tarquin should get all the credit for that, as far as I know. I think he found a label, the folks at Demon, and they were great. Ben Stanley are there at Demon. They're all great people. So endlessly patient with us because it took, I mean, when Tarquin brought the idea forward and kind of like, okay, let's do it. And it took, you know, I think I was, you know, I filled more of the detail role in the groups with making the list. So here's the list of all the songs. We got to pare this down. And oh my gosh, this is going to be a really tough job because I know we can't release every single thing. Yeah. And I thought the toughest job would be choosing what's in and what's out. I thought, oh, so we got to set our priorities. You know, what had the biggest prominent cue versus just something in the background. We got to develop a rubric and sort all this out. And then really that ended up not being an issue because shockingly and surprisingly, it wasn't that people didn't want to license their songs to the box set so much as that they didn't know who owned it anymore.
Right.
Like, how could that be?
Yeah.
I think all these companies have been merged and submerged so often. It's like, yeah, I don't know. Or at the time the song was, whatever contracts were written, you know, there was nothing specific about a future soundtrack album compilation 40 years from now. So no one's like, well, I have the rights for this, but I have home video, but not for that. And so poor Ben Stanley at Demon. But yeah, we went through a lot of.
Yeah, I bet.
Try again. Get this. We need this. Get that. But yeah, there was probably another full vinyl disc or another CD. It could have been just all the stuff that we should have had, but couldn't get.
Yeah,
for various reasons.
Just because I know the film so well and I've got some of the original soundtracks, I'm still missing some things. Like, so the Tone Loc song in Uncle Buck Wild Thing is not on there. Tweedledee is not on there. I did ask Tarquin this about, will we see any future John Hughes soundtrack releases on vinyl? And he said probably not. He just thinks that it's been done. But, I mean, if they brought out the soundtrack to Ferris Bueller, it'd sell like hotcakes because people have bootlegs of it.
Yeah, I don't. Well, again, very grateful the Demon took this step, and I just don't know if there's any money to be made anymore. I think if you're really interested in the completist, you can go online and make your own.
Yeah, get the CD or whatever. Yeah,
burn your own CD or make your own playlist or whatever you want to do. I think it's all out there to be had if you want to put a little effort into it. So I mean, in many ways, to me, the value of the box set was just the stories. And the information, I mean, the music you can get anywhere, really, if you're at all interested.
I mean, they're still bringing soundtracks out for older films and people are still buying them. So last year I got the Naked Gun, the first Naked Gun, which just came out.
Yeah.
And Summer Rental with John Candy. So, I mean, they're
Carl Reiner, right?
Yeah, correct. They're low numbered pressings. I don't know, maybe they're only like a couple of thousand, but, you know, people are buying them.
Yeah, Summer Rental. John Candy was great in Summer Rental.
He's fantastic. And Richard Crenna is the bad guy.
Yeah. He's great. Yeah, good bad guy.
Hey, you mentioned earlier around you don't go to the cinema that often. When you do go to the cinema, do you have a favorite cinema that you go to or like a local cinema?
No, it's all kind of sad. You know, growing up as a teenager, the old, at least around in Indiana, the old movie palaces had all been torn down and gone away. And they were all replaced by these sad
multiplex, horrible,
multiplexes. And looking back on it now, of course, at the time you didn't know any better. I'm just some dumb teenager, so what do I know?
Yeah.
But But I look back now and I think they were so poorly designed.
Yeah.
Just this long straight with an aisle in the middle. Who puts an aisle in the middle? There was a big aisle in the middle with seats on the left and the right with a small screen.
Yeah.
Just so when I got to Los Angeles and could still experience the glory of theaters like Mann's Chinese Theater and all those great theaters in the National, in Westwood, the National and the Crest and all those. Yeah, I'd say maybe going back, maybe Mann's Chinese, just that whole magic of the footprints and the cement and then just the huge screen. I think we had a couple of premieres at the Chinese.
I'd love to go there.
I'd say that's probably my favorite. Yeah.
It's so awesome that the first American guest I have on this podcast chooses Mann's Chinese Theater as their favorite cinema. I mean, it's great.
Why?
Well, it's just because it's such an iconic cinema.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's an interesting answer. I was just presuming you would say something in Indiana somewhere.
Tarot does have their old classic theater actually survived and was remodeled in the 90s. And it never quite had enough money to make the seats plush and, you know, really do it upright. And so it's a decent, it was a dollar, when I got to town and it was a dollar theater. So again, when a movie's at the very end of its run, they're gone now, but they used to show them for a dollar. You know, if a movie had been out for like a year, it's still in the theater somewhere, and you go see them for a dollar. And it was kind of a rundown dollar theater.
And
still,
is that the sort of place where they would just show the film continually? So that if you missed the beginning, you'd go into the next screening?
No, they didn't. They couldn't afford to be open that often. I think they had one showing a night on the weekend or something.
Gotcha.
Yeah, well, and when I was in Los Angeles in the 80s, there was an old theater near Westwood called the New Art. And it was like a kind of a second run, but not really. It was more of a revival. That's a better word. It was a revival theater. So in the 80s, you could go, and I spent many of the weekend at the New Art Theater where they would show like 6 hours of Charlie Chaplin. It would start at noon, and you know, or they'd do a Hitchcock triple bill. It'd be, you know, I'd sat through quite a few Hitchcock or Burt Lancaster triple bills at the New Art, you know, Elmer Gantry and Sweet Metal Success and Veracruz. So yeah, great stuff.
So obviously you became an actor sort of by accident. And then I looked at your IMDb. You've got quite a lot of credits on there.
Yeah, I need to maybe when I retire I'll make the effort to sort there's a couple different Ron Paynes. Only just a small portion of that is me. The rest of it's stuff I looked at it a few years ago, and it's like, oh, I should really write them and try to sort that out. I'll get around to it one day.
So were you in the George Romero zombie films? So Diary of the Dead and Land of the Dead. Oh, so that's not you. Oh, interesting.
No. If it's not John Hughes.
Right.
I'm in, I worked on Weekend at Bernie's 2 after, my voice is in that.
Oh, great.
But, other than that, if it's not John Hughes related, it's not me, it's somebody else.
Interesting. I have heard about IMDb being wrong, but this is probably the first example I've got. Also, you were in Serendipity with John Cusack and Kate Beckinsale. Obviously, that's not you as well either, then.
Oh, Kate Beckinsale, I wish. Yeah. No. Again, if it's not John Hughes or Weekend at Bernie's 2, it's not me.
Okay, interesting.
It's another Ron Payne.
Ron, do you have a controversial movie opinion?
All right. Half of your listeners are going to groan and turn it off, but
give it to me.
Star Wars, you know, nice movies, great. Yeah. I don't understand the fascination, the obsession, you know, the obsession that I share with the Beatles. I get it. People can have that about Star Wars. I just don't get it.
A few people have said this. Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it? Although it seems to, I don't know about you, but that fandom about Star Wars seems to be like dwindling, maybe. I don't know if it'll ever die, but you know, it's not as rabid as I previously thought. People are into Dune these days. I think the same people have transitioned over into Dune.
Oh, right. Yeah, I saw the first one, or not the first one, not the 1980s.
Oh, yep.
Colin McLaughlin version, but the one that came out a couple of years ago. But it's been so long since I saw it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll remember anything for part two, but I'll give it a go.
Yeah, the new ones, the first one, I thought it was so boring and just like really bland, but this second one, this new one is very good, I do admit.
Oh, you've seen it?
Yeah, yeah. And what don't you like in terms of movies?
Oh, what don't I like?
Horror? You also already mentioned horror?
Oh, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the horror genre. I mean, I remember seeing The Exorcist. I was in college, and my roommate and I went down, and they were showing it on campus somewhere, and we watched it, and going back to our rooms, I remember we were up most of the night, couldn't fall asleep, terrorized. the slasher or blood and guts stuff just doesn't do much for me. But other than that, as long as it's a good movie,
yeah.
What genre, what era, doesn't bother me. Just want to see a good one.
I think we're at the end. I've got one last question for you. Let me just double check my notes. I'm guessing IMDb is wrong again, saying that you were in a couple of short films last year in 2023. That might be another rampaign.
Nope, I left. I left Los Angeles in 94, right. 93.
Yep.
93 or 94. Not me.
I mean, I could talk to you all day about the Beatles. Maybe I'll call you back when I start a Beatles podcast. But Ron Payne, what film is absolutely perfect in your eyes?
Oh, golly. Well, Godfather 1, Godfather 2.
Guess what film
Citizen
I saw?
Kane.
Guess what film I saw yesterday on the big screen? I saw The Godfather.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Just near flawless. Or The Wizard of Oz, too.
Yeah.
Or It's a Gift. Have you seen It's a Gift by W.C. Fields?
I haven't, no.
Oh, my gosh. Do yourself a favor.
Okay.
See It's a Gift. Lafong. Carl Lafong. Oh, my gosh. That might be a near perfect movie. It's a Gift. Yeah.
If I forced you and you had to choose one, would you choose that one? I'm sending you to a desert island. You've got to take one film.
Oh boy. That's a tough one. Well, if it's a desert island, I only have one movie to watch for the rest of my life. It'd probably be Wizard of Oz, because you get a combination. You also get music in it too.
Sure. Fantastic answer. And I think you're the first person to say that film.
Probably your last.
No, I'm sure it'll come up again. Hey, thank you so much, Ron. This has been fantastic.
Oh, my pleasure, Johnny. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm a bit worried about the wind. For some reason, it started like blowing a gale behind me, so hopefully that wasn't too distracting.
No. There are beautiful scenery in the back, though. You're in New Zealand?
Yeah. So this is Auckland, New Zealand. So we're in the North Island. So our house sort of backs onto like a estuary, waterway. But yeah, it's really nice behind me. It's quite nice. There's some nice bird song behind me.
There was a TV show I loved from New Zealand, and they stopped showing it here in America. Now I've forgotten it. I just blanked. Rosehaven?
Oh, I don't know that.
Roseland? Rosehaven. I'm pretty sure it's Rosehaven.
Okay.
That came out a couple of years ago. It was really good.
Nice.
When I think of New Zealand, I also think of the Bats. You know, the Bats, the band.
The band,
from
yeah.
The 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an incredible music scene here. So all the Flying Nun stuff was, you know, quite famous in the 80s, and obviously I think people like Kurt Cobain sort of popularized that label as well.
Yeah, that Bats record, Daddy's Highway, is one of my all-time favorites.
Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Same here. Thanks, John.
Thanks again.
Thanks much.
Bye-bye.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
A huge thank you to my guest, Ron Payne. It was a true honour to speak to Ron, and so soon after my episode with Tarquin Gotch, two men who shaped movie music throughout the 1980s. Thanks as always to James Van Ass, who wrote and performed the brilliant podcast music, and to Willow Van Ass, who designed the amazing artwork and provided general podcast support. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a rating and a review on your favourite podcast platform. Follow the show on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter at MyMovieDNA, or email mymoviedna@gmail.com.